In episode 8, we talked about the pre-discard phase, how the narrative gets written before you are gone. This episode is about where that narrative goes next, out into the world, into your friendships, your family, your workplace, sometimes your whole community, often before you have any idea it's traveling. A smear campaign is not gossip, and it is not two people telling different sides of a breakup. It is a deliberate, managed story about your character, distributed on a schedule with an audience chosen in advance. The defining feature is timing. By the time you hear the story, the people hearing it have often been hearing versions of it for months. Here's what that looks like from the inside. A friend is slightly cooler than usual and cannot say why. A family member asks gently whether you've been doing okay lately, in a tone that suggests someone has already told them you haven't. At the separation or the discard, people you thought knew you go quiet. Not because they weighed the evidence and chose a side, but because a verdict was delivered to them long before the trial, and they did not know there had been a trial at all. The confusion this produces is enormous, and it is worth saying clearly, if you have lived this, you are not paranoid, and you are not imagining the pattern. You noticed a story arriving in rooms before you did, because that is exactly what happened. It also helps to name what the smear campaign is for, because it is not primarily about making other people dislike you. That is a side effect. It has three practical jobs. First, insurance. If you ever tell the truth about the relationship, the audience has already been taught to discount it. Second, recruitment. People who believe the story become willing carriers of it, which multiplies the reach without any further effort. Third, and least obvious, isolation. A person with no sympathetic witnesses is a person with no reality checks. And we know from earlier episodes what an isolation-ready environment makes possible. The smear campaign is not a tantrum, it is infrastructure. One thing before we go further, this episode is not going to tell you to fight for your reputation in every room, and it is not going to tell you that the truth always wins on its own. Both of those are fantasies. What it will do is walk through how the story is built, why reasonable people believe it, who actually carries it, and the small set of responses that consistently work better than defending yourself. Because the people who come through this best are rarely the ones who argued the loudest. They are the ones who understood what they were actually up against. A working smear campaign is not a list of accusations. It is a genre. The story almost always follows the same template. The storyteller is the calm, long-suffering one. You are unstable, difficult, or cruel. And every specific claim is small enough to be plausible on its own. Nobody is told she is a monster. They are told, with visible reluctance, I probably should not say this, but I have been worried about her for a while. The reluctance is the product. Concern reads as credibility, and the audience walks away feeling trusted with something sensitive rather than recruited into a campaign. That feeling is the entire trick. Notice also what the story is made of. The most effective material is not invented, it is repurposed. The night you cried hard after a cruel argument becomes, she has breakdowns. The time you finally raised your voice after months of provocation becomes, he has a temper. Your private disclosures, a difficult history, a diagnosis, a period of depression you shared in confidence, become exhibits. This is why the campaign is so disorienting to the target. The details are real. They are real moments relit and recaptioned, presented without the provocation that produced them. You end up wanting to explain each one, and explaining each one is exactly the trap. Because a person issuing correction sounds, to a primed audience, exactly like the unstable person they were told about. The reason the story works on reasonable, kind, intelligent people is that it exploits the shortcuts good people rely on. Most of us believe the person who speaks first and calmest. Most of us assume that where there is smoke, there is at least some fire. And most of us find the middle position, there are two sides probably both contributed, to feel like fairness. The campaign is engineered for that reflex. It does not need the audience to convict you. It only needs the audience to go agnostic, to step back, to stop checking on you, to hold you at arm's length until things settle down. Agnosticism is the win condition because an isolated target with sympathetic but neutral friends has, functionally, no allies at all. And there is a harder truth in this layer. The story works partly because it is simple and the truth is not. She is unstable and I tried everything, fits in one sentence. The accurate version, a years-long pattern of provocation, reversal, and managed perception, takes an hour and sounds to someone who was not there like a conspiracy. You cannot fix that asymmetry with volume. You can only fix it with time and consistency, which is the subject of the last chapter. First, though, it helps to know who is actually carrying the story, because they are not all carrying it for the same reason. Once the story is moving, it is useful to sort the people around it into three groups, because each group needs a different response from you. And most of the damage in this phase comes from treating all three the same. The first group is the true believers, people who heard the story early, absorbed it fully, and now treat your character as settled fact. Some of them were primed for months. Some of them simply find the story convenient. Either way, the defining trait of a true believer is that evidence does not move them. Your good behavior is an act. Your distress is proof. Your calm is manipulation. With true believers, the honest answer is that there is nothing to win. Every interaction is a performance review you will fail by design. The strategy is distance, not persuasion. The second group is the recruiters, what earlier episodes called flying monkeys. These are the people who do not just believe the story but work on its behalf. They pump you for information that gets carried back. They deliver messages. They pressure you to reconcile for everyone's sake. They report your reaction. Some do this knowingly. Many genuinely believe they are helping. The tell is directional. Information flows to them easily and from them never. They know things they should not know, and you know nothing you did not tell them directly. With recruiters, the tool is the same one we have used all season, the gray rock, the information diet. You do not confront them, you do not perform for them. You simply stop being a source. A courier with nothing to carry is just a person at a barbecue. The third group is the one that matters most, and it is larger than it feels in the worst weeks, the quietly unsure. These are the people who heard the story and did not quite swallow it. Something did not fit. They have known you for years, and the person in the story did not match the person at their dinner table. So, they went quiet, not from conviction, but from uncertainty and social awkwardness. They are waiting, not for a rebuttal, for data. Every ordinary interaction they have with you is being quietly compared against the story. And this is the one audience you can actually reach, because they are still watching. They do not need your case file. They need your consistency. Sorting people this way is not about becoming suspicious of everyone. It is about spending your limited energy where it can do something. Defending yourself to true believers spends everything and buys nothing. Feeding recruiters accelerates the campaign. But showing up steadily, warmly, and unremarkably in front of the quietly unsure is the single most effective counter to a smear campaign there is. The story says you are chaotic. 6 months of boring, reliable, kind behavior in public view is the rebuttal the audience can actually hear. Let us get practical, because this is the chapter people replay. The first rule is the one everything else hangs on. Do not chase the story. The instinct to correct the record in every room is overwhelming and completely understandable, and it feeds the campaign exactly what it needs, which is you, visibly agitated, talking about the conflict, confirming the genre. Every rebuttal you deliver to a primed audience is heard through the story, not against it. This does not mean silence in the face of everything. It means being deliberate about the difference between correcting information and managing perception. You correct information when there is a concrete, checkable fact and an audience that can actually check it, an employer, a court, a co-parenting schedule. You decline to manage perception everywhere else. Second, keep the record. The same private log we have talked about all season matters here too, but with a social twist. Save the message where the story shows its machinery, the text where someone repeats a private detail only one person could have given them, the invitation withdrawn the day after contact with a specific person. You are not building a case to publish. You are keeping yourself oriented, so that on the disorienting days, you can look at something solid and know the pattern is real and named. And in the situations that do turn formal, custody, workplace, legal, that record is often the only thing that stands between the story and a decision maker. Third, decide in advance what you will say when the story reaches you directly, because it will. And the moment is always worse than you imagined if you have to improvise. What works is short, calm, and non-defensive. A sentence or two, delivered once, with no follow-up campaign. Something like, I have heard there is a version of events going around. I am not going to litigate it person by person. You know me. Watch what I do and draw your own conclusions. You have told the quietly unsure exactly what they needed to hear, which is that you are not going to perform instability for their entertainment. And you have given the recruiters nothing portable. There is no quote in that sentence the campaign can use.
Fourth, and people resist this one, let the leavers leave. Some relationships will not survive the campaign.
And a few of the people who believe the story will be people you loved.
Grieve that honestly. It is a real loss on top of everything else.
But notice what the campaign just revealed. A friendship that could be taken from you by one calm stranger with a good story was load-bearing on your good behavior alone. The people who stay, the ones who watched, compared, and concluded the story did not fit, are not just remaining friends. They are a filtered, hardened, proven inner circle. Most people go their whole lives without knowing who those people are. You will know. That knowledge is one of the few genuine gifts of this whole miserable experience. The last chapter is the long one. What happens after the acute phase, when the story is out there and your life has to go on alongside it? Here is the timeline nobody gives you. A smear campaign is expensive to maintain. It requires constant feeding, new material, fresh management of every audience member. When you go quiet, go gray, and stop producing usable material, the story begins to starve. Not in a week, in a season. The storyteller is then left with a choice: escalate, which risks exposing the machinery, or let the story fade, which lets your consistency speak. Most campaigns do not end with a dramatic vindication, they end with a slow erosion, as the audience quietly notices that the person described in the story and the person at the school gate are not the same person. While that erosion runs, your job is to build a life that does not reference the story at all. This is the deeper move, and it connects to everything in the last episode about rebuilding identity. The campaign's final goal is to keep you oriented toward the storyteller, monitoring what is being said, managing your image, living as a defendant. Every hour spent tracking the story is an hour the campaign still owns. The real victory condition is not that everyone learns the truth. It is that you become a person for whom the story is no longer load-bearing. Someone whose friendships, work, and daily life run on direct experience of you, not on a narrative about you. Reputation built on performance can be smeared. Reputation built on years of witnessed behavior is remarkably hard to kill. Two cautions for the long road. First, anniversaries and escalations happen. A mutual event, a court date, a new relationship on their side can restart the campaign briefly, and it will hurt like day one. Expect the flare. Do not read it as proof the erosion failed, and return to the protocol. No chasing, keep the record, one calm sentence, consistency. Second, watch the temptation to build your identity around the campaign, to become permanently the person who was wronged by it. The story does not deserve that much real estate. You were someone before it, and the whole point is to be someone after it. So here's the one thing to try this week. Make a private list of the quietly unsure. 3 to 5 people who went silent but never went hostile.
Then give each of them one ordinary, unremarkable data point. A coffee, a message about something that has nothing to do with any of this, a show up where you are simply yourself.
You are not campaigning. You are doing the opposite of campaigning. Letting reality accumulate where a story was planted. Next episode, we are going to look at what happens when the contact resumes after all of this. The Hoover that arrives months later, dressed as accountability. Until then, the story about you is traveling. Let it. You are busy living the rebuttal.